Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here. That sounded like a different bird. It sounded like that bird was dying at the end, and I don't know if that's the way it always sounds, but we've had that for a long, long time. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason, and welcome to the show. I have an open mic call day today. I'm off schedule. The day this is being broadcast, I'm actually in Tucson, Arizona, so I can't be with you live. But we will be taking your kind of quasi-live calls here, our open mic calls, and that is when you have called in at a different time and left a recording of your question, then we'll play that, and then I'll respond to you as if you were here, except we won't be able to interact. But it's great. It's a great opportunity for me to have your calls when I'm not on live for you to call me. And that's why you call open mic calls, that you can actually record. If you go to our homepage and then on the podcasts link under live podcast, I think you go homepage, then podcast, then live podcast. The instructions are there, or you can simply do what I think most people do. Not most people, some people do. They actually dial in to this number, 857-DIAL-STR. 857-DIAL-STR, and then you can follow the prompts. The number's there, 857-342-5787, 857-342-5787. That's the 857-DIAL-STR number. So anyway, that's how we get those calls, and I'll be covering those in a moment. But I want to make an observation. In 1976, I spent 3.5 months in that summer of 76 in Europe as part of an enterprise that me and three other people did, bought a car in Switzerland and then drove through a whole bunch of countries in order to encourage Christians, especially those behind the iron curtain. And we spent 5.5 weeks in the East, which is a significant amount of time. It was a kind of undercover affair. We weren't there to smuggle Bibles, though we did bring Bibles with us. We weren't in smuggling mode. That is, we didn't have them hidden anywhere. They were just in our luggage. It freaked out the Ruskies, though, for sure, when we crossed into the former Soviet Union at Moldavia out of Romania, and they found we had already gotten into Hungary and then Romania without any difficulties. We got into the Soviet Union. That was where we hit trouble and were detained, I don't know, 15 hours at the border, whatever. I actually talk about that experience in a piece I wrote a couple of years ago, For Solid Ground. It's actually available online. It's called Iron Curtain Diary. So I recommend you take a look at that. And the reason I'm bringing it up now, almost 50 years later, is because of the circumstances that we faced there, observing what was happening to the Christians. And when we were interrogated that at the border, once they discovered our Bibles and they just tore our car completely apart, you know, and had it up on the rack a couple of times and pulled panels off, and they're looking for the hidden places, which there weren't any with our vehicle. The Bibles we had were English and Russian. Actually, those were the important ones, Russian and a concordance and some hymnals in Russian. And that freaked them out. Anyway, they confiscated those and then interrogated us for, I don't know, we were probably held back 8, 10, 12, 14 hours, something like that. And the interrogation wasn't like, you know, under the white lights, we have ways of making you answer these questions kind of thing. No, it was just an in-tourist interpreter, and they just pummeled us with questions, and I record the details in this article called Iron Curtain Diary. It's from maybe 2 years ago, 2020, or maybe 2021 in January. 21. Okay, thank you, Amy. So it's online if you want to look at that. But there are two parts of this that are important for what I have to say in my opening remarks today. And the first part is that when we are at the border, we were confronting them as they are questioning us about the freedom that they allegedly had in their country, freedom of religion and freedom to have Bibles, because they said, we have freedom of religion here. But, they said, we have separation of church and state. Now, this was a phrase that we used frequently there, and honestly, it made no sense. Well, how is interfering with us trafficking in scriptures, even in the small amount that we had that weren't hidden, how is that somehow a violation of the principle of separation of church and state? But it became, pardon me, a kind of catch-all phrase to justify all the interference that they were making in our lives, and they wanted to know who we were going to talk to, who we were going to give these Bibles to, and whatever. So we didn't give up our, you know, our contacts at all. We just said we're traveling as tourists, and we expect to talk to people about Jesus and give them a Bible if they like. We already have Bibles here in the Soviet Union. We have all the Bibles we need, but then they said, you can't bring these in because this is anti-communist propaganda. But then we asked, wait a minute, you say you print Bibles here in the Soviet Union. Yes, we do. But these Bibles are anti-communist propaganda. Yes, it is. Well, then you're printing anti-communist propaganda right in your own country. To which they responded, yes, but we have no, but we have separation of church and state, is what they said. So the first point is, here we have a repressive regime, a totalitarian government that was hostile to Christianity, who was continually using the phrase separation of church and state to justify all kinds of interference with religious liberty. All right? And in a way that the phrase made no sense. There was no application, it seemed. So I'm just making note of that. I have heard this phrase obviously bandied about for, you know, a long time, even before I came on the scene, separation of church and state, which, by the way, is not in the Constitution at all. It's a phrase that was used by Thomas Jefferson in a letter that he wrote to a church in Danbury, Connecticut, assuring them that they would not be interfered with because of the wall of separation between church and state. So the state was not going to interfere with them. Nevertheless, this became the operative phrase of the Bill of Rights concept that was doing the work, has been doing the work for a long time, in people's minds at least. Now, of course, the Bill of Rights never uses that. It says that the First Amendment says that Congress will pass no law that will infringe on the freedom of religion and speech, etc. So the non-infringement clause has been recharacterized as separation of church and state. And then this language has been used to justify all kinds of government interference in people's free exercise of religion, okay? Just like the Soviet Union. It's exactly the same thing. What I mean is the way they were using the terminology in both cases, then and now, is accomplishing the same end, which in our case is to interfere, give the state an opportunity to interfere with religion. And if we complain and try to raise issue, then we're guilty of violating separation. This is the way it plays out. So we entered the Ukraine for Moldavia, then the Ukraine, went to Kiev and spent time with the family of a Soviet dissident Christian who was in Siberia, in the labor camps there in Siberia, because he was a Christian. He's no longer alive, but he was one of the leader of the Reformed Baptist in the Soviet Union, Gorky Vins. And we were with his family. And then we traveled from there into, that was the Ukraine. Then we started at Kiev, and then we started moving west again and stopped in a little town called Rovna. And Rovna was heavily persecuted. Further west was Lvov, and Lvov had a lot of open display of Christianity. We went to a church there. But in Rovna, there was a lot of persecution. And so we made our way to the house of some Christians there. It was actually a couple of mothers that were living together, as I recall. And a very, very modest house. I think it was like a one-room house. So they had kind of beds off to the one side. They had a place for cooking, whatever. And the four of us, one by one, made it to this location. And actually, one of our members had been there earlier and arranged for this interaction. And so we spent time with them. And these women were living, they were married with children who were living by themselves because their husbands were in prison for being Christian, and their children had been taken away from them because they were Christians, and they were teaching their Christians about I'm sorry, they were teaching their children about God, and because they were giving their children a religious education, they had their children taken away from them. Now this obviously sounds like I can't believe it. Can you believe it? I can't believe it. No, we couldn't, because this was what happens. I mean, we could under those circumstances, because this is what happens in a totalitarian regime. Now I'd like to read something from February 20th, 2024. That was 1 week ago from the day that I'm preparing this broadcast. Fox News. And it's an article, excuse me, about what's happened in the state of Indiana. And reading from this, written by Kendall Tietz, I guess her name is T-I-E-T-Z. A Catholic couple in Indiana is asking the Supreme Court to hold the state accountable for keeping their child out of their home after they declined to use his chosen name and pronouns. Apparently, Indiana Department of Child Services were involved here, and this family, Mary and Jeremy Cox, appealing to the Supreme Court after they were investigated by Indiana officials for refusing to refer to their son using pronouns and a name inconsistent with his biological sex. So here are parents that are misgendering their child, their minor child, in their care. They are misgendering him, which all that means is he wants to be called she and also a female name, apparently, and they won't do that. That's it. Beckett, apparently this is an attorney, is pursuing the case on behalf of the Coxes, arguing state courts allowed Indiana to keep the child from living in his parents' home due to their disagreement with the child's gender identity because of their religious beliefs. So let me pause for a moment. I hate that phrase, because of their religious beliefs. Do we really have to appeal to a religious belief to demand that the state not take our children away from us because we have misgendered them? Can't we simply appeal to parental rights or to common sense? Why does this have to be a religious beliefs issue? That's crazy to me, but it's come to that, is what I'm saying. Okay. Notably, I continue, upon completing the investigation, the state determined the allegations of abuse against Mary and Jeremy, the parents, were unsubstantiated. In other words, they had not abused their child. The state agrees, but still argued that the disagreement over gender identity was distressing to the child. Lori Windham, vice president and senior counsel at Beckett, told Fox News Digital that no parent should ever have to endure what Mary and Jeremy have been forced to go through. Keeping a child away from loving parents because of their religious beliefs. Again, as far as I'm concerned, you can strike that phrase. Even when the state admits there is no abuse or neglect is wrong and against the law. The court should take this case and make clear that other states can't take children away because of ideological disagreements. So what do we see here? And incidentally, this is Indiana. I read something the other day that apparently the state of Illinois is considering legislation that would allow the state to do this, take the children away from parents who are not affirming a child's gender identity that's different from their sex. And I guarantee you, this is going to continue. Now, here's my point, and many of you have already made it. You understand that what has just happened in Indiana, what they're trying to litigate regarding going to the Supreme Court is the exact same thing that happened to those women 50 years ago or so in Rovna, Ukraine, who had their children taken away from them by a despotic government because of ideological disagreements. I remember we were joking after that border confrontation and the repeated use of separation of church and state. We were joking, they're trying to separate the church right out of the state. But of course, it's no joke, because that's what they were doing, and we see more of this kind of thing happening here, but especially when children can be taken away from parents because their parents misgender. Anyway, I just wanted to read this to you to alert you what is happening here in this country. I'll continue here. In 2019, Mary and Jeremy's son told them that he identified as a girl, but in line with their Catholic religious beliefs that God created human beings with an immutable sex, male or female. No, duh. You can remove all the religion from that line, and you still have a common sense, scientifically sound principle that human beings are either male or female. That's it. And that can't be changed. Anyway, the parents did not believe in referring to him using pronouns and a name inconsistent with his biology. In addition, the Coxes believed their son was struggling with underlying mental health conditions, including an eating disorder, so they sought therapeutic care for both. By the way, in the state of California, it is not even legal to get therapeutic care for children that are minors struggling with gender dysphoria. You can't help them get their mind squared away so that their thinking is consistent with their body. It says in 2021, Indiana officials began investigating the Coxes after a report found they were not referring to their child by his preferred gender identity. Now, this is a curious sentence, isn't it? After a report found? What does that mean? How does a report find something? The report found out they weren't referring to the child by his preferred gender. No, the report didn't find out. Somebody reported them. And that's how they found out. And so they removed the teen from their custody and placed him in a gender-affirming home. Despite the unsubstantiated claims of abuse, they claim the Coxes made the child's eating disorder worse, even though it worsened after he was removed and placed in a transition-affirming home. Let's see, the Office of the Attorney General for Indiana, Todd Rokita, told Fox News, "We always protect parental rights and religious liberty." Really? "Neither we nor the Indiana courts believe that the state can remove a child because of a parent's religious beliefs, views about gender identity, or anything of the sort. Our office is fulfilling our statutory duty to defend this state agency and to keep an oath I swore when I took office. As the record shows, this state agency acted not on the use of pronouns, but because the child's extreme eating disorder," which apparently got worse when they moved him to a gender-affirming home. This sounds like they're covering themselves. Indiana governor sets DCS policy and hires those employees. This is a continuing the citation from the AG of Indiana. "I am sympathetic to the parents, and everyone who follows my work as Attorney General knows that I am the biggest defender and proponent of parental rights." Well, Mary and Jeremy Cox said in a press release, "This is what every parent is afraid of. We love our son and wanted to care for him, but the state of Indiana robbed us of that opportunity by taking him from our home and banning us from speaking to him about gender." Okay, so you got two different stories here. One from the AG and one from the parents. AG says they weren't caring for his eating disorder. Attorney General. Parents say this is all about gender affirmation. I guess you have to decide. I think that I trust the parents, not the Attorney General. Just saying. And so what we have here, if the parents are right, and by the way, like I said, there's other legislation moving forward in other places that will make parents misgendering their children actionable. And so how's this different than the former Soviet Union? Just saying. All right, let's take a break here, and then we'll get to your open mic calls on Stand to Reason.
Do you have a passion to train people in apologetics, but you don't know where to start? You may be interested in starting an STR outpost. STR outposts are local communities of Christians seeking answers to the hard questions about Christianity. Each outpost is led by a qualified director who trains others with STR content and curriculum in their local church. By becoming an outpost director, you will be equipped with the content and coaching you need to lead your own outpost. We currently have more than 60 outposts across the country, and we're adding more each month. If you're interested in learning more about starting an outpost, or you want to find a current outpost in your area, visit str.org/outposts. You can also email me, Robbie Lashua, at outposts@str.org.
Friends, if you like this broadcast, I know you'll love #STRAsk. It's our shorter 20-minute podcast where I am paired with the wonderful Amy Hall, and together we answer the questions you send us on Twitter. #STRAsk is released twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays, and it's only about 20 minutes long, so it's perfect to listen to on your morning jog or while driving around running errands or cleaning your garage or just plain loafing at home. Amy and I tackle your questions on theology and ethics and culture and lots more, offering our insight on the questions you're asking or the challenges you face. You can listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your own shows. Just remember, send us your questions on Twitter using the name of the podcast, #STRAsk. That's #STRAsk. All right, well, we have an extremely strange circumstance that is like midday, right in the middle of off schedule broadcast. We have somebody calling in with a question, so I can actually take a live call here from Michael in Kentucky. Michael, welcome to the show.
Hello, Greg. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you fine. This is it's so unusual for someone to call during this time, and I just happen to be here broadcasting, so I'm happy to take your call.
Oh, I'm honored. Thank you for taking the time to hear my question.
Sure, of course. Ready? Yes, sir.
Okay. Mike, I read your book, Tactics, and I loved it. No, I'm not just saying that because I'm on your show. I loved it. And I want to deal with the question. So anyone else that doesn't believe just like you is going to hell, I used your tactics from your book. And sometimes, however, the other person traps me by saying, so the answer is yes. I mean, is there any way to dodge around that question, or just can I just be honest and say yes? I mean, I know you say it'll confirm a stereotype, but I don't know what else to do when they say, so the answer is yes.
Yes. Yeah. This actually is in the book because I was talking about a conversation I had on a TV debate with Deepak Chopra, the New Age guru.
I saw the debate. Good job.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for that. But I also was taken to task by someone because... What's that? Something's going on in the background. I don't know what that is.
It's a train whistle. Hold on a second.
Okay.
It's over.
Tell the train to stop. It's noise. All right. Got it. But I was taken to task about this because my characterization was not precisely the way that Deepak Chopra had put it, but it was really the spirit of it. And that was, So you're saying basically people who don't think just like you are going to hell. Now, the problem with putting it that way is that it makes it sound like we are condemning people to hell because they disagree with us instead of understanding the point we're making. So, for example, if you went to a doctor and a doctor said you had cancer and you are going to need chemotherapy or you're going to die, and then you say, oh, so you're saying I'm going to die just because I don't believe exactly the way you believe. Well, it's not because he doesn't believe the way he's supposed to believe. He believes, like, because there's a disagreement. It's because the analysis is that the person is sick and needs care. And so what we're saying is, and at this point, when people make this point, and maybe you offered this response, we need to clarify exactly what's going on here. People aren't going to hell because they disagree with us. And that's the way I think Deepak was trying to make it sound to other people. In that discussion, by the way, I think I sidestepped that issue and was made a different point, as it turned out. But still, it needs to be answered. And the clarification is, what we're saying is, we think people are dying of a spiritual disease and that there's an antidote to the spiritual disease. If you don't get the antidote, then you're going to die. And there are spiritual consequences to dying without the antidote, all right? The spiritual consequences are hell. But they're not going to hell just because they don't agree. They're going to hell because they have broken God's law. And that's what God will judge them on. Now, it could be that we're mistaken about this view. Yeah, that's certainly possible. But what we are doing is advancing the view and offering reasons for it. We are not simply saying, if you don't believe just the way I believe, then go to hell. I hope you go to hell, and then you will. And I'm happy with that, which is the way this characterization of the issue sounds. And so, you know, people have said, if you word a thing just so, the right way, you know, you can win the argument just because of the way you word it. And that's what this does. And so when somebody approaches me or says something like this to me, then I'm going to have to clarify, I think you misunderstood my point. And now if I clarify and then they still say, so in other words, if we disagree with you, we're going to hell. I said, that isn't what here's what I would say. I said, that isn't what I said. Somebody isn't going to hell because they disagree with me. What I said is somebody is going to hell because they're going to be punished for their crimes against God. That's what I said. Now, you could say that's true or that's false. However, we can discuss about that. But when you characterize it this way as disagree with me, then you've mischaracterized my point. And that's called a straw man fallacy, by the way. So now if somebody wants to continue to press that point, I'm not going to concede their point and say, yeah, I guess you're right. If they disagree with me, they're going to hell. Because now I'm buying into the linguistic maneuver that they've offered to play this whole point against me. And what I want people to do is understand what's at stake here. What we're saying is, and back to this medical illustration, people are dying of a spiritual disease. And that's our claim. And we are also offering an antidote that's free. But what they want to do is characterize us as kind of ugly in the process. This is just a kind of a narrow-minded, bigoted point of view, which isn't what we're trying to communicate. Does that make sense to you?
It does. It just seems to be like every unbeliever's secret weapon. And that's what, I looked up all the best ways to dance around it, but I just, I'm trying to have my dad come to Christ, but he's an atheist. So he always presses me on this point. So the answer is yes. It comes up. So I needed some help. So I appreciate you taking the time to help me with this.
Well, just think
I've been praying a lot for him.
Yeah, God bless you. That's great. But you know, this is where I'd want to push back a little bit. And I would say, because atheists think they're the smart ones. Okay, fine. Okay, my point is going to be, I think if somebody had this conversation with me, is I think that you're being intellectually dishonest. It's one thing to disagree with my point, say I think you're mistaken. It's another thing to mischaracterize it and make it sound ugly and not be willing to be fair-minded and at least characterize it accurately. Our view is that people have sinned before God, and because of that, they're culpable. They have broken the law, and therefore, they are vulnerable to judgment. Now, there's a way out, and it's called mercy, okay? And that is available through Jesus, okay? So this isn't a mean-spirited, narrow-minded, arrogant kind of message that we're offering. We're offering a way out of a serious problem. Now, can we be wrong about this? Of course we could, in principle. But what he has done, and he apparently continues to do, is just continues to mischaracterize it. And I'm not sure why a person would keep doing that. You know what?
I don't either. I'm as lost as you are.
You might ask him that. You know, why is it that you want to? Why do you keep mischaracterizing in this way? If you think that I'm mistaken about my view, you are free to tell me the reasons why I'm mistaken. Okay, here's a little bit of an irony here. For an atheist to put it the way that he did, is to suggest that what you are doing is untoward in some way. This is like, well, this is arrogant. This is nasty. This is mean. You're so, you don't believe it your way, then you're going to hell. Okay, notice, though, that what that amounts to is a moral judgment. Your view is somewhat, like I said, untoward or immoral. The problem is, coming from an atheist, there is no way that anybody else's view could be untoward or immoral. Because there is no morality. There is no such thing as morality. Just like Richard Dawkins has said, there is no good, there is no evil, there is nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. That's the world of materialistic atheism. So notice how your father, and it must be hard for you to manage this. I understand that.
It is. It's hard for me not. I'm sorry to interrupt, Greg. I'm sorry. It's very hard for me not to get emotional because I just worry for him.
Yeah. Well, because it's weighty. I get it. I understand that. And trust me, I've been in these circumstances before myself with people very close to me who have a completely different view. That's completely irrational, and it's a weighty thing, and it matters, but you can't get them to see. But this is where I think sometimes, maybe as a last ditch effort, it's just a question: why do you keep doing this, or an appeal to intellectual integrity? Why do you keep characterizing my view this way when it really mischaracterizes my view? If you want to refute my view or disagree with it, you're fine to do that. Okay, I'm not offended, but you keep asking me to characterize this in a way that's not accurate, but seems to benefit your side. And by the way, what you're doing is saying I'm a nasty guy, which implies that it's bad, and I'm not sure where you're even getting your moral standard from to begin with to judge my behavior. So it's doubly problematic in that it's importing a moral standard that he has no right to, given his worldview, and he's also mischaracterizing your view, which is a fallacy called a straw man fallacy, which if smart people shouldn't be doing that kind of thing. So
no.
There you go.
I thank you so much, Greg. Is there any way to, I think I heard this was being recorded. Is there any way to re-listen to this? Because I really want to get these into my brain.
Is there a way to listen to what I just told you?
Yeah, again,
let me tell you. Hold on just a second. Okay, Friday, March 8th is when this broadcast will be aired or will be available to listen to. Friday, March 8th.
Where can I hear it?
You can go to SDR.org and right there on our homepage. You can also subscribe to the SDR podcast and go wherever you go, Apple and other places that process those.
Okay, sure thing.
There's also an STR app that you can listen to our podcast on.
Okay. So March 8th?
March 8th. Is that what you said, Amy? Yeah, March 8th.
Okay. Listen, I just thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Malcolm, really... God keep you. And I pray that your conversations with your father will go better than they have. And let me just offer this thought, too. I became a Christian in 1973, and in 2000, so that's why 27 years later, my dad became a Christian just a year before he died.
My dad was a tough character. I'm so grateful that worked out.
Yeah.
It really brings a lot of great joy for me.
Incidentally, it had very little to do with my direct involvement. I'm just saying it was the way the Lord worked it out. He had heard the word from me and my brother and the rest of us, and also from his sister. But when he faced a life-threatening surgery, that's when God got his attention, and he had a very traumatic conversion. In other words, he was a very different person after his conversion than before. My dad was a labor union leader in Chicago. So you can imagine. So he was a tough nut to crack, but God cracked him. I didn't crack him. God did.
Only God can change your heart. It's hard for me to, I'll be honest, it's hard for me to remember that sometimes when I read so much apologetic material. I just like, can you please just consider this? I'm begging you. I mean, I don't say it like that, but just like, yeah. I sometimes get carried away in my own knowledge and I forget that only God can change your heart. So
yes.
I hope I can.
Well, no, but you do play a part. And so you do what you can do, and then you just have to trust God with the rest because that's all that's available to us. And some people are not. At this stage in life, they're not open. They are open to arguing, bantering, making you look silly or ridiculous if they can, because there's an ego thing going on, which is why people do this, argue in this kind of way. You know, it's belligerent. It's not even-handed. But nevertheless, that's just the way sinners are, you know, unregenerate sinners. We're all sinners, obviously, and we all have to watch for this, but unregenerate ones. But God has a way of getting people's attention. And I do know there was a lot of prayer put in on behalf of my dad over the years, much of it mine. But I'd gotten to a point I just quit praying for him. You know, it's just, all right, this is the way it is. What am I going to do about it? You know, and my attentions went elsewhere. But nevertheless, God still has had his plan, and he worked that out. And when I talked to him on the phone, I was quite stunned to hear what he had to say and how tender his heart was to God when he explained this to me. And so, you know, that's, and I got to see him again before he died. We all went actually to his home in Florida, all of the children, pretty much all of our children. And it turned out he was going to get baptized, and there was a conflict with his wife that, you know, it was just too hard. She was so upset. So he didn't get baptized. But my youngest sister did. And that was when her genuine walk with the Lord, I think, actually started. So I, you know, God has his ways. He knows what he's doing. We pray, we say what we can, we do what we can, and then we just have to leave it up to him.
Thank you. Because I'll be honest, Greg, I don't, when it comes to people converting to Christianity, I don't have much patience because we can go at any time. And I just, when I think of my loved ones, I mean, I know we can be happy without our loved ones in heaven, but when I think of, like, say, my dad possibly not hearing the word of Christ and not getting there in time, I'm filled with dread and just terror. So that's why I don't have much patience. But I'm just pray for patience.
Yes, sir. That's right. That's one of the fruits of the Spirit. And by the way, that is something I prayed. There were three fruits of the Spirit I prayed for many years: patience, gentleness, and self-control. And I needed all of those. And by the way, over the years, I actually feel—I'm convinced that God answered those prayers. But He doesn't answer those kind of prayers very quickly. It just took a lot of time.
Yeah, I've learned that the hard way.
Patience, gentleness, and self-control. Now I'm on love, joy, peace. That's the first three: love, joy, peace. Oh, hey, I need more help there. So I'm just breaking the ice now on love, joy, peace, and hopefully before, you know, I shuffle off this mortal coil, those fruits will be evident in my life much more than they are right now. So one step at a time. Okay, Michael?
I will. Thank you, Greg. I know you probably have other calls to get to, but just to say, again, thank you from the bottom of my heart, and I thank you so much for what you do to help people find Christ. I know it just means a lot. So thank you.
You're so welcome. Get the iPhone app if you have an iPhone, and or then you'll be able to listen to the broadcast, or you can download to your computer from Apple and subscribe to that, or you can just go to our website on, what, March 8th, I think Amy said, and then you can listen to it there. So did you say March 8th?
Wait.
Yeah, I think, yeah. Okay. Hey, thanks so much, Mike.
Thank you, Greg.
Bye-bye.
God bless.
Bye. You know, Michael said you got so many other callers to get. No, not the case, not today, because I'm not even on. Talk about threading the needle, like that was a divine accident. But I'm glad I got the chance to talk to Michael. Let's go to break, then I'll come back with more calls here on Stand to Reason.
As a high school teacher, I always had a red pen close at hand. When I wasn't in front of my students teaching a lesson, you could find me assessing assignments, grading essays, and evaluating exams. The red pen played a crucial role in the educational development of my students. With it, I questioned their assumptions, exposed their errors, and challenged them to think critically. You see, a good teacher doesn't merely tell his students that they're wrong. A good teacher shows his students why they're wrong so they don't make the same mistakes twice. He corrects because he cares. Last year, I was scrolling through social media, and frankly, I was discouraged at all the bad thinking that undergirded much of what I was reading. Then it hit me. What if someone applied the red pen to this flawed thinking? And Red Pen Logic with Mr. B was born. In the last few months, Red Pen Logic has grown in popularity. Through our engaging and shareable educational graphics and videos, we are helping people, especially young people, assess bad thinking by using good thinking. And we have a lot of fun in the process. So here's your homework assignment. Like the Red Pen Logic Facebook page so you don't miss our next graphic. And subscribe at the Red Pen Logic YouTube channel so you don't miss a single video. Class dismissed.
You can take Stand to Reason with you through our mobile apps, available for free from the App Store or the Google Play Store. The Quick Reference app gives you short, easily accessible courses on our most popular topics like tactics, homosexuality in the Bible, morality, the story of reality, and many more. The Stand to Reason app has all our latest content available at your fingertips. You can listen to our podcasts, check the blog, and access timely and practical resources. They're free, so download the apps today on the App Store or the Google Play Store and start carrying Stand to Reason with you everywhere you go. If you enjoy our apps, you can help other people find them by rating them on the App Store or the Google Play Store.
All right, let's. I'm looking at some of the calls that have come in here. We got one from Paul J.C. I can't pronounce his last name. It's Italian, it looks like. But it looks like a, I don't know, I just can't even say it. So let's hear from him.
Hi, Greg. This is Paul from Nampa, Idaho. And I have a question about students, young people, teenagers who use names other than their given name. I'm encountering way more students this year who have a name other than their given birth name by their parents. And I'm kind of wondering, what's the difference? Where's the line between a student taking on a different gender name and just having a nickname? I mean, that's kind of the question I posed to my colleagues and haven't really gotten an answer as to when is it a different gender name versus just a nickname. So if you could give some insight on that, I'd appreciate it. Thanks.
Sure, Paul. First, let me explain the view that we have at Stand to Reason on this and how we counsel other people regarding names as opposed to pronouns. And I did talk about this in Street Smarts as well. And the way we look at it is names are conventional. That is, they're conventions. They're invented things. And even though names often, in a certain sense, don't travel, they're like Susan. That's my sister's name. You're not going to call a guy Sue, although there was a song called A Guy Named Sue by Johnny, Man in Black. What's his name? Who is that, Johnny? Johnny Cash, yeah. Guy named Any event, they don't travel, okay? So that looks like a... It's not like Mike. Mike could be a guy or a girl, you know, or Pat or something like that. So that's a name. Those are names that travel. But our view was basically you call people by the names that they choose for themselves, partly because names are conventional. And even though in certain circumstances you have names that seem to be clearly and irreconcilably associated with a particular gender, what's the alternative? If you've refused to call them by that name, what are you going to call them? Oh, you're not a Sue. I know you're not a Sue. You're a guy. So what was what's your real name? Now, what do you got now? A fight on your hand. And it just begins to seem like you're being mean-spirited. So there is a modest accommodation there to a name that reflects a different gender than the person actually is or a different sex. But it seems to me it's an accommodation that we can make because the alternative is just not workable. Unless you're a parent, when you're a parent, then you have the prerogative of requiring your children to adopt a name that is appropriate for their sex. That's a little different matter. That's what parents do. Even though, unfortunately, in some cases, this might mean that you're going to have trouble from child services. In any event, so we think names are conventional. Pronouns are not. Pronouns are tied to sex. So him and her are not terms that are flexible and can go with anyone. They are tied to sex. Now, of course, the political environment now is that these are terms that are very fragile, or rather malleable, and they can be applied in however, with whoever. Now, we don't agree with that because pronouns are not malleable in that way. They are not conventional. They are tied to sex. And so, therefore, to use a pronoun that's inconsistent with sex is a denial of reality. You're living according to a lie, and you're giving in to a narrative. You're cooperating with a narrative that is ultimately destructive. This is so obvious to so many who are clear-thinking people. This is destructive to the kids, especially if they start going trans. In other words, they take drugs that are meant to be consistent, help their bodies to be consistent with their gender identity, and maybe even have operations. It's just terrible, the mutilation that's going on in the name of love and compassion. This is not good for them. Now, as a teacher, and I think, Paul, that's where you're at because you're talking about students and nicknames. Well, of course, what I've said so far covers nicknames. If students want to use a name other than what they were given what their parents gave them, they're free to do that. If it's just a nickname, hey, like Billy Bob, or, you know, people used to call me Kook or Kookie or Cocoa Puffs or stuff like that because of my last name, which never bothered me. I always thought it was distinctive, and I never felt like I was being made fun of, or if I was, it was in a good way. So it never bothered me, but those are just kind of nicknames. Actually, my brothers and I, all three of us, we each call each other Kook. I know it sounds like K-O-O-K, like you're a kook, like you're a crazy person, but we think of it as K-O-U-K, like you're a Kook, like you're a cockle. That's the way we think of it. In any event, hey, Kook, you know, that kind of thing. No big deal. That's our, in a sense, our nicknames. But since names are conventional, even nicknames, there's no problem there. So I think if you're a teacher and you have students using different names, even nicknames, there's no concern as far as we're concerned regarding those names, because we choose to use the names that the students use for themselves or want to be called. I think that's fine. That's a reasonable accommodation to this issue. It is an accommodation, but it's a reasonable one because the alternative is worse, it seems to us. But I think it's appropriate to draw the line when it comes to pronouns. And incidentally, and I said this in Street Smarts, I've mentioned it on the air before, but if somebody asks you for your preferred pronoun, any answer you give is going to be wrong. And what I mean by that is you cannot answer that directly without affirming the narrative. Because if you're cisgender, for example, in other words, if your gender identity matches your sex, like mine would, he, him, male, okay, then you would say, well, my preferred pronouns are he, him, because that's appropriate for my sex. But when you say they're your preferred pronouns, you're already affirming the narrative that says pronouns are a matter of preference. And that's why any answer you give to that is going to be wrong. The way to respond, I suggest, is to say, I have no preferred pronouns. I have a sex. I'm a male. And there you're directing the attention to your sex and therefore implicitly suggesting that people address you with pronouns appropriate for your sex. not consistent with your preference, because pronouns are not a matter of preference. Okay. So I hope that helps, Paul. Let's see. We got about 7 minutes left. Shall we take let's take Timothy Phillips' question on hypnotism. There's a lot of noise in the background. We'll live with that. Kids. Oh, I guess there's no noise. Long silence.
Hi, Greg. This is Timothy calling in from Malaysia. I really appreciate your show, and I try to listen to each one. You make me a better husband because I don't mind doing the dishes when I'm listening to you and Amy. Speaking of wanting to become a better person, my question for you is, can Christians make use of hypnotism to overcome issues they are struggling with? For instance, if I wanted to overcome an addiction to vaping or gambling, or if I were struggling with pain or anxiety, would it be okay to see a hypnotist? Obviously, the hypnotist would need to be someone trustworthy. I don't understand how hypnotism works, but it doesn't seem to involve spirits or anything like that. Are there any theological reasons why Christians should not use hypnotherapy?
All right, Tim, thank you for that question. And man, I don't think I've gotten this question for years and years. And I think among Christians, there is a there's kind of a split decision. I used to work with a guy named Craig Hawkins here in Southern California, a very fine apologist who had done a lot of research in the occult. And of course, now I'm trying to think what he would have answered here. I think he was suspicious or concerned about it. Now, clearly the scripture doesn't speak directly to it. But what hypnotism is an altered state of consciousness. And altered states of consciousness make you susceptible to powerful suggestions. Of course, that's the point of hypnotism, right? And under hypnotic influence, you can have suggestions that are made to you that do address maybe bad habits that you have or things that you're trying to resolve in your own life. I don't know about anxiety. So my dad was a smoker for a long time. He started smoking when he was 15 and quit when he was 55, but he smoked a lot. I don't know how many packs a day, but packs. So he was a heavy smoker. And when he was 55, he quit smoking through hypnosis, and it was cold turkey. The way I understand it is that he was able to the hypnotic, post-hypnotic suggestion was adequate to take away all of the desire for him to smoke, and he kicked the habit. And good for him. Now, cancer still took him, lung cancer that metastasized to his brain 25 years later. Is that right? 55, 60, yeah, 25 years later. So, but he was able to quit for that whole quarter century of his life, which is good. Okay. So this was before he became a Christian. He became a Christian right at the end. So it does seem to be something that can have a salutary effect. But I guess my response would be maybe. And I'm not speaking to somebody, maybe it's okay, maybe it's not. And I wish I had something more concrete to give you. I'm trying to remember what Craig Hawkins used to say. He was a martial artist, too. And lots of times with martial arts, there is an influence of Eastern religion or cultic stuff. And in his mind, it was possible to engage the martial arts aspect without engaging the spiritual things that sometimes go along with certain types of martial arts. So it might be the case that hypnotism could be useful here. I guess Christians are concerned that given an altered state of consciousness, you are going to be open to suggestions that are not going to be helpful or good for your spiritual life. So I guess I'm just going to leave it open here that there may be some risks involved, but not necessarily. And an individual is just going to have to decide for themselves. You might touch base with some other Christians who know a little bit about the occult and see what they say. I have Melissa Doherty's a friend of mine, and she's got a background in New Age and stuff like that, and maybe she would have a different opinion about this. I don't know, but it's just an open issue. Now, keep in mind, by the way, we experience altered states of consciousness all the time, like when you watch TV. What do? You just kind of go into a trance, don't you? You lose track of time because you're watching something that's engaging. That is an altered state of consciousness of sorts. So not all altered states of consciousness are particularly damaging to you. It just leaves you open to some degree, obviously, to post-hypnotic suggestion. And when you're watching TV, it's not exactly hypnosis, but sometimes it feels like it, right? Especially you have kids that are riveted to the screen and you're trying to get their attention. Hey, 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 it's Dad. I'm over here. Hey, look. And you kind of got to break the trance, so to speak, to be able to get through to them. And in those even altered states of consciousness like that, that delivers, has the ability of delivering certain messages through the media. That is very powerful and just something to be aware of. But so I guess I'm not, I'm just going to sit on the fence on this one, on the hypnotism issue. And that may bother some people who are listening. If you have a different opinion, I'll be glad to hear about it. I'm open. But I don't have an enduring resistance to this notion. And I do know in my dad's case, it did help him. And I don't, nothing strange happened to him as a result, except for he stopped smoking. So I guess there was therapeutic value to it. That's the best I can do right now. Thank you for your call, Timothy, and thank you for the rest of you listening here. That's all the time I have for today. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give him heaven, all right? Bye-bye now.